The 50th anniversary of the historic Stonewall Uprising is on June 28th. The New York Public Library currently has a Stonewall exhibit on display, curated by Jason Bauman, and the Stonewall Reader honors the most significant event in the gay liberation movement by reminding readers of the power of everyday resistance. Again, the name of the book is The Stonewall Reader, a collection of first accounts, diaries, periodic literature, and articles from LGBTQ magazines and newspapers that documented both the years leading up to and the years following the Stonewall riots of 1969. Again, it's The Stonewall Reader, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Jason Bauman to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Give us a sense of how this book came in connection also with the exhibit and ultimately what you had before you as a project to put this all together.
With the exhibition that's here at the library, it really covers early 1960s through sort of mid to late 1970s, showing changes in LGBT culture and politics before and after the riots, really as a way to appreciate how much things changed because of Stonewall. And so the show is mostly photographs, particularly by these two photographers, Kay LaHusen and Diana Davies. And so we did the anthology with Penguin in order to give really the reading. You know, we have sort of the look of what did it look like, what happened, but the anthology is so people can read these first-hand accounts and also have a deeper dive into our archive. We have one of the great collections of LGBT magazines in the United States and of LGBT literature. So it's for people to get these first-hand accounts.
How did that collection start?
The main of our LGBT political collections came around in the 1980s, and there was this independent archive, the International Gay Information Center, that had grown out of the Gay Activists Alliance. And it was an independent library, and eventually it sort of outgrew the volunteers who were taking care of it, and they gave it to New York Public Library. And it had the archives of Mattachine Society of New York, also Gay Activist Alliance, and this enormous periodical and book collection. But it's also been a strength for us going further back in the 1960s. For instance, the librarians would go out to Times Square and buy in erotica, but also gay books in the many magazine shops that used to be in Times Square years ago. And even back to the early years of the library, we have one of the great collections of Walt Whitman's manuscripts in the United States. LGBT culture and literature has been a theme for the library since its founding, but really these political archives came in the 1980s.
As I indicated in the introduction, the book is put into three categories: before Stonewall, during Stonewall, and after Stonewall. Let us begin with before Stonewall, because that really could be anything leading up to 1969. What were you looking for to set the stage, if you will?
Two things. The first is I wanted people to get a feeling of what it was like to be gay or lesbian or transgender in the United States in the 1960s. And there are also some original documents, like this flyer that was created by Mattachine in the 1960s for one of their meetings that's penalties for sex offenses in the United States, where you can see the legal penalties ranging from 3 months in jail in New York to possible life in prison in Nevada in the 1960s. So you can really sense the oppression that people suffered in the 1960s, but also to get sort of an insight into the pioneering activism that was already happening in 1950s and 60s. Many people think that Stonewall was the beginning of this movement, and actually from the 1950s on, you have Mattachine Society, the Daughters of Bilitis, Janus Society, Erickson Educational Foundation, and many others. So there's already this pioneering political movement, but very small groups of people across the country.
Talk a little bit about the Gay Crusaders.
Oh, the Gay Crusaders is this wonderful book that was done by Kay Tobin LaHusen. And so we have Kay and her partner, Barbara Giddings, who were really pivotal activists in the 1960s and 70s. And Kay did this book of interviews with all of the major activists in the United States in 1971. And so we have excerpts from some of the interviews that she did for the Gay Crusaders. It includes Barbara Giddings, her partner, but also Craig Rodwell, who ran Oscar Wilde Memorial Bookstore, which was first gay bookstore in the United States, and with others. And so it was a way to resurface this material.
And then you read about during Stonewall, and you were looking for on the ground at the moment accounts, I assume?
Yes, from participants, and either things written shortly after or things from people's memoirs. So we have the coverage that took place that was in the Village Voice, because there were two reporters from the Village Voice who were there, and one was inside and one was outside, and they were published as The View from Inside and The View from Outside. Also Dick Leitch, who ran the Mattachine Society in New York, and his coverage that was the hairpin drop heard around the world, and then interviews, oral histories, and excerpts from people's memoirs. There are many people that don't realize that a certain person was at Stonewall. For instance, so we have Holly Woodlawn, who was this actress, transgender, with the Andy Warhol sort of factory scene, who was at Stonewall. Jane County, who's a transgender punk rock musician, who was at Stonewall. Edmund White, major writer. So many, many people whose lives were touched by Stonewall, and getting their firsthand account of not just what happened from their perspective, but how it felt to be there.
You mentioned Edmund White, and as you write in the book, that he first wrote about Stonewall in his novel The Beautiful Room Is Empty, and then he went to describe it in more detail in his memoir City Boy. What do we learn from that part of the book? Because it's a different take, isn't it?
Yeah, Edmund White, he has a, and this goes to show people have very different takes. I think White really wants to remind people that it was, his thing is, it's about pleasure, right? It was about the ability to have freedom, to have enjoyment, because it's a bar, right? And he really sees that pleasure and carousing were at the heart of what people were fighting for. And in a way, he's right. In New York City, a bar could lose its liquor license, or people, patrons could get arrested or be refused service in a bar if it was known that they were gay. Also for cross-dressing. And so this was a major focus of gay activists in New York City, in Mattachine in the 1960s, and they had this demonstration, the sip-in, where they went to various bars demanding a drink and trying to order a drink as an out homosexual. And so there is about this right to nightlife. It was that nightlife is a political issue, and that is a part of Stonewall.
You get the sense in reading most, if not all, of the selections in that particular part of the book, about during Stonewall, that there was a real understanding that what was happening at that moment was very important.
Yeah, I think the people who were there knew that something new was happening. There had been other riots, which is other misconception. People think it was the first of these riots, but across the 1960s, there were a series of these riots in L.A., in San Francisco, in Philadelphia, in San Francisco, Compton's cafeteria riot. But I think at Stonewall, people realized that something historic was happening. And I think also just felt liberated by many of the participants. It was like a kind of rite of passage that they had finally stood up for themselves. It was, I think, Martin Boyce, whose memoir is most powerful in this regard. He remembers people even looking at him differently, of heterosexual people he knew sort of being amazed that gays and lesbians and transgender people had stood up to the police and against authority, and that he was changed personally by his participation.
Talk a little bit about the revolts that preceded Stonewall and their importance, and how ultimately they really colored what happened on that day.
So, and I don't know if there was a tremendous amount of interchange between the people who were in each of these riots, but I think from Compton's cafeteria, there was Deuce Restaurant, there was Cooper Donut, and I think with each one of those riots, the political community grew a little bit stronger and a little more confrontational. So, for instance, with the Dewey's Restaurant sit-ins that were in Philly in the 1960s, that led to picketing and led to a whole growth of the political community in Philadelphia. The same with the Black Cat, which was, I think, just before maybe 67, 68. I forget the exact year of Black Cat.
I think 67.
But leads to all of this activism in Los Angeles, and also actually the founding of The Advocate, the gay and lesbian news magazine. So I think each of these helped gays and lesbians and transgender people push the envelope. We became more developed as a political community, and really that was the groundwork that allowed us to, with Stonewall, really to run with that moment. You know, if there had, and that, I think that's the other thing, is if you don't realize there was this political community right after Stonewall, already Mattachine is flyering and trying to, with and we have some of these flyers in the book, of trying to recruit people to gay and lesbian activism after their participation in Stonewall and capitalize on that event. So without that political community, it would have just been a random moment, right? But since the political community was developed, they could capitalize and run with it.
The third section of the book, as we mentioned, covers the after effects of the Stonewall protests. Talk a little bit about how this event brought this new wave of LGBTQ activism.
After Stonewall, Manasheen and others try to recruit people into this new movement. And it's also, you had with Stonewall a whole new generation of people who were radicalized by that experience. Many of them much younger than the 1960s activists. Many of them are radicalized by involvement in the peace movement against the Vietnam War, by the Black Power movement and civil rights, by feminism. And they have a whole new energy and a whole radical frame of reference that's very different from the 1960s activists. And so they quickly create their own organizations, the first really being Gay Liberation Front, which is very radical and events really this new spirit of gay liberation. And Gay Liberation Front in itself is kind of a catalyst that throws off all these other movements in this Gay Activist Alliance, the Radical Lesbians, Third World Gay Revolution, and Street Transvestite Action Revolutionaries. And all of these groups actively recruit and even send activists on road trips around the country to start chapters, mostly through the student movement and student associations at colleges all over the country. So this whole new, very confrontational, counterculture kind of movement of gay liberation is born and spreads all over the United States.
What impact, and I assume it's profound, but the impact that the AIDS crisis beginning in the 80s had on the movement as it was really just starting to get going?
It sort of ends in the late 1970s. But with AIDS, it's dual, because in one way, I think AIDS made gay men visible in our society in a way that we had never been visible before. In some ways, it was, crippling and devastating to us as a community, but also, I think, revived that spirit of activism from the 1970s. There were many people in New York and around the country who had been involved in gay liberation, and then with the rise of activism in the AIDS crisis, brought all of those lessons and all of those tactics to bear in the activism they did around AIDS. It was very clear with ACT UP, which is a major AIDS activist organization here in New York and around the country. So many people had been in the Gay Liberation Movement and Gay Activist Alliance a decade before and then brought that to bear. So in a way, it's also part of that continuity of LGBT politics.
And yet, then you look at where we are in the current state of queer activism in the midst of a military ban, a trans military ban, increasing homophobic language from the highest political offices in this country, certainly a lack of protection for LGBTQ youth. Where do you think we are as a result of Stonewall and where we are now?
Yeah, it's a very complicated moment, and particularly looking back at these things from the 1960s, like in the anthology, we have pieces by Frank Kameny. Kameny was an astrophysicist and gay, and he loses his position when it's found out he's gay because it's a government job. So he really devotes the rest of his life to activism for federal employment and the right to be in the military. And so it's you have this arc of this activism from the 1960s, almost 50 years of activism to get full right to serve in the military, and then for it to be taken away now. At the same time, again, reflecting on Kameny, he's the first gay person to run for Congress, right, unsuccessfully, but to run openly in 71, and now we have a mayor in Chicago and a possible presidential candidate. So the moment is, I think, very ambivalent and both exciting and terrifying, because history doesn't go in slow progress towards a utopian future, but goes in ups and downs and reversals. But I think the other thing with youth is I think it's useful to read these histories from the 60s and 70s so that young people today can realize that they can be politically active too, you know, that it's not hopeless, and that really generation to generations before, these activists from the 1970s, they were 18, 19, 20 years old, right? And they really transformed our society. So I would love for young people today to feel empowered as well.
Should also note before we end, and that is there's just some beautiful writing in the book.
Yeah, isn't it gorgeous? And some by literary writers, you know,
yeah.
And some by people who aren't literary at all. I mean, I have like John Retchie and Audre Lorde and some less known, Joan Nestle, is a very important activist, but a really great memoirist and novelist. But even some of the accounts by people who participated in Stonewall, Tommy Lanigan Schmidt, his gorgeous piece about his experiences. So, yeah, it's also a good read, which is something I really tried to have things that would be passionate and engrossing and transformative to read.
It is The Stonewall Reader. It is edited by the New York Public Library and Jason Bauman. Jason, thank you very much for spending time with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is The Stonewall Reader, edited by Jason Bauman and the New York Public Library, and is published by Penguin. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.